This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, let's talk to Pastor Dave, Mubs. What do you think? Huh?
Sure.
I want to talk to this guy because we all know that we've had a couple of guests in here over the last year or two who've had interesting stories, fascinating interactions with substance abuse and all kinds of things. And Pastor Dave reckons he's one of those people. And it seems from his case studies that he's the kind of guy who can get you off of the bad stuff and onto the good stuff. So let's welcome him to the studio, shall we? Gotta have the proper intro. Here he is. He's sitting right in front of me. Pastor Dave Barber. How are you, Pastor Dave?
They're very well in yourselves.
Yeah, good, man. So, yeah. First of all, you're from Vereniging, so we won't hold that against you.
Thank you.
All right.
Wasn't always that way.
Sure. Second of all, you used to be in the police.
Yeah.
And we say fuck the police here a lot of the time, but with you, we'll hold back on that as well.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we should also hold back on the swearing, because he is a pastor.
Sorry, I forgot about that. I haven't been to church for a long time.
I think the reason I got on drugs is because I said the same thing. Eh?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Right.
So you were in the police. I mean, that must have helped. And the reason I'm building up this story is because we'll get to the point where you understand what a lot of people are going through, because you were there.
Yeah.
You're also a former drug addict.
Correct.
What were we on?
My main drug of choice was crack cocaine, but pretty much whatever was put in front of me, eh?
Really?
Yeah.
So tried a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah, I think the only thing, because it wasn't available at that point, was crystal meth is pretty much the only thing I haven't tried. But other than that, yeah, you can pretty much name it, eh?
Sure.
Yeah.
Did the police work get you into the drugs? Because you guys would bust people for drugs and you would take their drugs away and you'd think, oh, well, let's try this.
It eventually became like that. But actually what got me started on the whole thing is actually the F.W. de Klerk speech, the change of the government in 1990.
Didn't take a lot to inspire you. That was one of the most boring speeches I've
for
ever
sure.
heard.
For sure. But you
we
know,
are going to release Nelson Mandela. That got you. You got all fired up. You were like, fuck, I'm getting out of this.
Yeah, for sure. Because, you know, they'd made us believe a certain thing. And it turned out to be an absolute lie. And I pretty much went back because I was in Hillbrow Police Station, and I went back with this attitude, you know, screw these guys, you know, I'm going to get into it for myself. And I started hanging out with criminal guys and moving with the criminals, and they were mostly using drugs and then got involved that way. And I actually identified with them more than I did with my peers in the police.
So did the other policemen know that you were on this stuff?
Eventually, I became something of almost a leper.
Sure.
Yeah.
And Hillbrow Police Station, that must have been a tough place to work.
Yeah, you know, particularly during those years, you know, because we were pretty confused, you know, as to what our role really was. You know, I joined the police to be a policeman, and I ended up being in the police as a political tool and implement. And it was a very confusing time. And a lot of the stuff we got involved in really just, you know, you can't process it mentally. And so once you find out that drugs are able to also mask that, you get more and more involved in the drugs. So, and as you trying to identify with both the police and your mates, who are, first of all, the first mistake I made is that most of my mates were colored and black guys, and I was a white cop. And the second thing is that I was doing drugs with these guys and hanging around with these guys. So that didn't sit very well. That's why after 7.5 years, I mean, you know, I still left the police with the rank of constable. I never got promoted at all. Yeah.
And unlimited supply, I'm sure, because you were the guy busting all the other guys.
Yeah, so it's pretty much, I don't know if you ever watched a program that used to be on TV, The Shield.
Yeah.
Pretty much that, eh? You're just as criminal as the criminals, but you're using that also to a certain degree to maintain some kind of law and order.
Did you make some money on the side?
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, the thing is back in those days, there was a limit to what you would take money for. You know, you wouldn't take money for things like murder or rape or armed robbery or any one of these serious, heinous crimes. You know, petty kinds of things we would take money for, like gambling on the street or or these types of, like, really petty crimes. You take a 50 rand or 100 rand there. But, you know, in terms of taking large sums of money for serious violent crimes, and that, in no ways, wouldn't happen.
And then you also, I mean, because that is crime, so you're a criminal, but you're also the guy kind of trying to find the criminals and put them away. It must have been very confusing for you at that stage. I mean, you've got a lot of different things going on in your life. You've got major moral, ethical questions, but you've also got a habit that you can't ignore. How the hell do you break out of that?
You see, the thing is that what people don't understand, at that point, you're 19 years old as well.
Yes.
So, you know, you've come out of high school from a protected environment. I come from a middle-class home, had a good education. My parents were both professional people. and you come out of this background, and now you're stuck into Hillbrow. And you're 19 years old. The first thing that you see is policemen shooting everybody, and it's just crazy stuff going on. And now you're on the drugs, and now you've got this moral battle going on in your mind. So it is. It's very, very difficult to try and process all of that. And ultimately, it ended up with me being suspended from the police, committed quite a serious crime.
What was that?
Myself and another policeman set up a fake armed robbery, which ended with him being shot.
Dead?
No. Thank God not. And ultimately what then came out is that he was actually a serial killer. He'd murdered prostitutes and gay people in Bromfontein.
Nice guy.
Fantastic individual. He's currently doing 90 years imprisonment.
90, okay.
90 years
imprisonment.
He's never coming out. No, he'll never come out. And
And this was your partner?
Yeah, he was a guy. Well, he wasn't my partner. He was a guy that was working at the police station. It's a crazy story. He broke up with his girlfriend and then got his hands on an R1 rifle. And went and sat on the top of the barracks and started shooting at people in the street and at the station commander. And he was never charged with any of that. He was just taken from his position as a patrol officer and put into the officers in charge.
Was he mentally ill?
Yeah, definitely. And, I mean, we all picked it up, particularly when he used to drink, you know. And then they did a really intelligent thing, Gareth. They put him in charge of the funds and the safe, you know. And
wow.
Yeah. And then he was pilfering from that. And they were going to do an audit, you know, as they do annually. And he came to me and said, look, you know, he needs a cover for the audit.
Yeah. What kind of stuff do they have in a safe in a police station?
They've got the informers fees. I'm talking about the financial side.
Oh, okay.
You know, the informers fees, the barracks fees, the salaries for the at that time for the blue collar workers that clean the police stations and that type of thing. So, you know, there's a lot of money floating around there.
Sure.
So he'd already stolen a vast amount, and now the audit was coming and he needed to cover it up. And that's when he approached me because he was aware of my problem. I was smoking crack, I had a nickname. I don't know if I can use it, but my nickname was Gary Kirsten because I was opening batsman and I never left the crease, you know. So he approached me because he knew of my criminal background and that, and we set up this thing.
Wow, Dave. Now, for most people, this is where the story would go south. You'd end up in jail forever. You'd be a disaster. Maybe get out one day and just be angry with the world, because that's what usually happens.
Yeah.
But how do you turn that around?
Hey, man, I don't know. This is where, you know, my whole belief in God's plan comes into the thing, because as I was released from Brixton Murder and Robbery, which, first of all, was a hair-raising experience in itself. I was approached by then members of the Civil Cooperation Bureau to share information with them on certain things that were going on in Johannesburg at the time. And, of course, I pounced on that because they gave me guarantees that they would assist me. And because I gave a confession to Brixton Murder and Robbery in front of a magistrate, they dropped all the charges from the armed robbery to the attempted murder to the theft of a state firearm, and I was only charged with theft. And I was ultimately then only convicted of theft, and which has also somehow been expunged over the last 20 years. And I ended up doing getting a 3-year corrective supervision sentence with community service and all of that. And then this is the irony in the whole thing. 18 months later, Nelson Mandela declared a moratorium and a whole lot of us got amnesty. And I was one of those that got amnesty. So, I ended up doing pretty much half the sentence for a very serious crime and pretty much got off the hook. But, you know, as that was going on, still had a drug habit, still had to fuel that drug habit. And, crime,
already.
Straight out crime and bouncing in nightclubs and whatever went with that. Eh?
Jesus, that's not an easy life. I mean, it's horrible for people around you. Did your family understand any of this? Were they supportive?
They didn't know. They didn't know.
You managed to keep it from them?
Yeah, because, I mean, I was pretty, you know, I've always been a pretty solitary dude. I didn't have a very good relationship with my mother. My father left when I was very young, and I grew up with my grandparents. So my real interaction with my mother and that side of the family, with her new family or her new life, was pretty much a year. You know, that was my entire involvement.
So you were left to your own
devices. You know, when I left home at the age of 17, I went to Hillbrow as a cop. By the time in the book, if you read it, you'll see by the time I was 18, I'd been introduced to chronic violence because we had, it was the late 80s, we had all the riots going on and all these types of things. So it was hectic, eh? Very hectic.
And you were also, you admit in your book that you were full of hatred and prejudice yourself.
Sure.
Like you were a racist. You didn't particularly
Absolutely.
Like anybody.
Yeah, look, it's a joke I make with the guys, but a lot of the guys don't realize how serious I actually was at that time. You know, I say to guys, I was never a racist. You know, I hate everyone equally, psychologists diagnosed me as a textbook sociopath at the time, I just had no time. I looked at human beings as a cancer, if you will, of the world, especially as a cop in Hillbrow as well. You see things there that are just, just defy any kind of humanity or logic, ridiculous things, drunken men raping their children and people throwing people off balconies and the most chronic things. I once witnessed a prostitute in Hillbrow walking the beat there in Soper Road on crutches with two broken legs with pins sticking out of her shins and that. And I said to her, I knew her very well, and I said to her, what's going on here? She said, I've got to do it. I owe him 150 rand, and if I don't do it, they'll chuck me out the window again. So there she is, trying to earn this money with this type of horrific setup.
It sounds like a nasty, nasty place to find yourself. And yeah. I'm still not sure how you get out of that. And I can start to see now how your story must be inspiring and at the same time must have been informative in putting you in the position you're in now, where you advise other people how to improve their own condition. So how do you begin? Did you meet someone? Did you have an epiphany? Is it like
combination?
Like St. Paul, you suddenly see God arrive in the sky and he says, "Oi, I've got a job for you."
I wish it was.
How does it happen?
I wish it was that easy. Some guys have had that experience. I personally haven't had it. I ended up in such a bad position. A friend of mine's sister was a alcohol addict, and she was in a very notorious recovery center down in the Karoo.
Okay.
And I ended up there. And
oh, you did?
Yeah, I was there for 6 years. And I was also involved with all that rubbish that went on down there, And
Well, we had a guy in here the other day who was telling us it was great.
It was. For me, it was great.
He got cured. He's got a wife and kids, and he's a happy dude now. And
for sure.
Not for you.
No, for me, it did me a lot of good, eh? The message that was spoken down there really hit a nerve with me because the facilitator at that time was also a hardcore ex-criminal and went through all of it, and it really, really touched me. But even though when I was there, I was on top of the world and it really did well for me while I was there. But I was unable to sustain what I'd learned there in can I call it the real world?
Yeah.
And, coming out here back into the cities, I immediately came back, no job, nowhere to go, didn't know what to do, and immediately migrated back to what I know, which is the clubs, the drug scene. I was also part of the most notorious bouncing syndicate that ever Joburg ever saw back in the late 90s, early 2000s. So, I was part of that whole scene, and it was very easy to migrate there because also you must remember, for a person that's struggling with self-esteem issues and that, bouncing and running drugs and that type of thing gives you quite a superiority complex. You have quite a.
I meet these guys, and they stand outside the club, and they're very important, and they're powerful, and they threaten everybody, and they are. They're usually big guys. They could really hit you hard if they needed to. And you get the feeling that deep down inside, they have self-esteem issues. They're unhappy about who they are, where they've got to in life. They're miserable about their position in society. They always owe someone something. Someone always owes them something. It's never a let's meet as equals relationship.
Yeah. For me, I can only speak for myself. For me, because I was in such fear, the best way to hide that fear was to put fear into others.
Yeah.
So, that's pretty much, and also I'm not a small guy. And when I am training and when I was younger, it's very easy to do
that. To intimidate.
Yeah, quick, man.
Okay, so you got back into this despite the supposed rehabilitation that you had.
Yeah.
So now you're almost even further down the road.
Correct.
You're not coming back anytime soon. What happens?
You start losing hope. you completely lose hope. And I said to the pastor down there one day in a meeting there, I was in tears and broken.
You already had joined a church then?
Yeah, I'd been in and out of Christianity. You know, the first time I had an encounter with God was at the age of 12 in a boarding school down in Klerksdorp. And
he didn't touch you inappropriately, did he?
No. Oh, it wasn't okay, sure. That kind of school. Yeah, okay. I know a few jokes like that myself, but some of them aren't funny because they're not jokes. Yeah, no, sure. But
so look at us laughing at that. Yeah, nice. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Absolutely. So, you know, the thing is that I said to him, I said, you know, everybody and myself must just accept that this is who I am. I'm a drug addict. I'm destined to be a drug addict. You know, God doesn't want to speak to me. And quite frankly, at this point, I really don't want to speak to God. I've had enough of all these stories. And, you know, just let's accept the status quo is what it is. You know, destined to go to prison for life. Because ultimately, when I'm on drugs, I'm not the nicest guy in the world. And I'm prone to violence when I'm like that. And with my violent background, the police and all of that. So, you know, ultimately, that's where I'm going to go. I'm going to go to prison. And I ultimately did end up in prison for a while for committing house breakings for drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Also, woke me up properly. Good wake-up call. I recommend prison for
really?
I do. For people that really don't understand where their drug addiction is going to take them, to put them in prison for a couple of weeks, I really think is a proper wake-up call. We had a you know, I don't know if you watch Beyond Scared Straight running on Discovery or CR channel.
I've seen little bits of it, yeah.
So they've got a program in the States where they take kids into the prisons and they have them pretty much have prisoners scare the shit out of them, you know.
Yeah.
And we had some youth with us once and we were running a program called Celebrate Recovery in Deepcliff Prison. And one day we took some of these youngsters with and they allowed them into the prison. And while we were facilitating the program, these youngsters were standing behind us giggling and all this. And a couple of the prisoners got up and came to me, and hardcore dudes, man. Said, you know, can we have a word with these youngsters? You know, we don't find this amusing. You know, one guy's there doing 50 years for killing his wife and his daughter while high on crystal meth. So he didn't really take to this.
Doesn't seem like a regular comedian.
So, yeah, you know, I don't know, you know, what kind of language you allow here, but I'm going to say it exactly like it was said.
Go
and
on.
He said, can I speak to these guys? I said, sure. And these prisoners surrounded these school kids. And he looked at him and he went, took a deep breath, you know, through his nose. He says, you know what, boy? He says, you smell so fresh, you actually still smell like pussy.
Yo.
He says, we will kill each other here just for the right to sell you.
Yes.
So don't stand here and laugh at us. All right, it's not a joke. That kid went from being a juvenile delinquent to leaving school with 6 distinctions, buddy.
Ben likes this kind of thing. Ben is in favor of this kind of tough love.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, you know... So prison, yeah, you know, it does have its for people. You know, I don't believe in incarcerating people that are pretty much. I don't like using the word sick because I don't believe it's a disease per se. But I don't believe that incarceration and criminalization for people that are addicted to substances is the way to go. It hasn't worked for the last 50 years. We really need to look at it a different way. And you know, but at prison, really, it is a wake-up call for people whose lives are busy spiraling out of control, and it really can make you reevaluate your life. Eh?
So, Dave, tell me about how you've managed, because I don't entirely understand. To me, often religion is just taking on a different addiction. It's not a bad addiction,
yeah,
and that's the difference.
Yeah,
but it's like, you know, you replace this need, whether it's with drugs or with alcohol or with women or with whatever it is, with the need for a father figure in God. And for some people, that's very rewarding, and it gives them all the meaning that they need in life. And I don't have any problem with it. Let me be absolutely clear about that.
Yeah.
But don't you think that the addiction is still there? It's just been transformed.
You know what, I agree with you more than 10,000% on that issue.
That's a good number.
Yeah, it's huge.
Happy with that number.
But yeah, fantastic number. And I'll tell you why.
Good return on the investment.
You see, we've got into a system or into a thought pattern, I believe, you know, and once again, it's just an opinion. You can agree with it or not agree with it. But my opinion is that pretty much every human being on this planet is addicted. You're designed to be addicted. It's an intrinsic part of your humanity to be addicted to something. You know, some people are addicted to golf. Some people are addicted to. I myself, other than being addicted to the Lord, I'm addicted to riding motorcycles and dirt bikes and that type of thing. So
sure,
I believe that addiction.
You want to get those endorphins
running,
going.
Buddy. Yeah.
Sure, I'm with you.
So when you know, for me as a person who lived that lifestyle, you know. ultimately, I got to the bottom of my bottom one day, you know, and it wasn't a financial thing or anything like that. At that point, I was pretty financially okay. I was married, and I'd relapsed, and I'd completely destroyed her life and my life through my addiction again over a period of 2 years. And I was really at a place where it was either suicide or it was make a change. And I ended up in a recovery center down in Greytown.
Did you think about suicide?
I've tried to commit suicide twice.
How did you try and do it?
I tried to shoot myself and missed.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
So you actually fired the bullet and you missed.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a cuck shot, hey?
Terrible. And I was only like 2 centimeters away from my head. So, and you know, sometimes
what the hell? You see, cops can't shoot. Cops
can't shoot, but that's why crime is where it is.
No, but seriously, you actually pulled the trigger on the gun.
The first,
where did you have it? In your mouth?
No, I had it against my head, and okay. I drank a copious amount of Johnny Walker Black. And taken copious amount of, I don't know what pills, whatever I could find.
What is the thought before you pull that trigger? What are you thinking about? Are you just like, I'm out of here?
Yeah, it's, for me, it was like, you know, I just can't do this anymore.
Shame,
you know?
Man,
and for me, Gareth, it's pretty much about, it wasn't really about self-pity. It was about, look what you're doing to the people around you, bud.
Now, this wife of yours.
Yeah, I should have brought it with
her. She must have been a hell of a woman to sit through all of this with you.
Hey, man, that poor girl, hey, let me tell you, when she met me, she came to a birthday party at a club called Inside Out.
I remember that.
And I was managing the security there for that bouncing crew.
Right.
And, you know, I spoke to her and we went on a couple of dates and, you know, I told her that I was a recovered addict and it's okay to take ecstasy because I'm not smoking rocks.
Right.
And, you know, I had her believing all of this because she was a corporate woman. She was a national sales manager for the largest aluminium manufacturers in Africa. So she'd been in that game for 20 years and very successful in her own right. And, yeah, she hit out with this complete criminal. And, I took her down a road, you know. She says now that, you know, I educated her about life. You know, she lived in a bubble before she met me.
But she stuck with you.
Stuck with me, eh? Like a pit bull, eh? And, you know, I'm very appreciative. It was actually through an experience. You talk about Paul seeing the light. Mm-hmm. You know, that it was an experience that I had with my wife that actually turned the whole thing around, eh? I don't know if you watch these movies, they like these, usually these teeny bopper movies where people swap personalities. Mm-hmm. I had a supernatural experience where God allowed me to feel her pain for pretty much a second and a half, and I just pretty much couldn't handle it. And right there, for the first time in my life, I said to somebody, what do you want me to do? And she gave me the criteria of what she needed me to do in order for her to continue living, and that was go back to rehab and do what I promised that I would do. And that's when the whole process started in 2008, eh? And haven't touched drugs since then, eh?
And now you've got this drug rehab center of your own.
Yeah, and that's also a crazy story, because when I came out of recovery, I went into the forest and I had a chat with no one, if you want, but for me I was having a chat with God.
Sure.
And I said, God, you know, if you take this nightmare out of my life, you know, I'll go anywhere and say anything you tell me to or show me to. Because I don't audibly hear the voice of God. I have like something that comes out of my spirit. Mm-hmm. And then I walked out of the forest and I realized what I'd said. And I like went back and I tried to add an addendum to my promise.
You
mean, and I said, hang on, let's not adjourn this meeting just yet. No drug addicts, please. Yeah. I don't want to work with drug addicts. And I really do not want to go back to Johannesburg.
Too late though.
And I walked out the forest.
Did God accept the addendum?
No, because here I am, you know, and, you know, I really, you know, man. It's something I really, if we have a moment, I really want to talk about is, you know, the industry of drug rehabilitation in this country.
And do you think it's a rotten business? Tell me what you're thinking.
My personal view is, I think that the people, that are fueling the addiction industry. I'm talking about the legal addiction industry, you know, alcohol, mm-hmm. prescription medications, pornography, gambling, these types of things. Really need to, you know, start sowing into people's problems. The addiction industry, the only stats we have, which are so, they're not even conclusive stats. They're mm-hmm. like thumbsuck stats, I believe, you know, that people have sort of tried to put together. You know, they say that in 2008, which is the last stats we have on it. You know, the addiction industry made over 20 billion rand in profit in 2008. And we say to them, you know, what are you putting back into people's lives that are addicted to your products to the point where they can't control themselves? And then they turn around and say, oh, no, we're doing a lot. And we say, what? Well, we've got posters up, you know, saying what? No, saying drink responsibly. I said, wow, that's fantastic. You know, they tell an alcoholic to drink responsibly. I dare you. Good luck with that. You know, it makes no sense. I said, why don't you
they're
guys?
They're already so drunk they can't read your poster.
You know, guy's hanging off the side. he's so drunk he's hanging off the side of the pavement. He's got a bottle of, you know, methylated spirits in his hand. Yeah.
He's hey, buddy, really, you know, he's going to read your poster.
Yeah, drink responsibly there. But, you know, you might as well put posters up and say, smoke crystal meth responsibly.
Yeah.
You know, it really makes no sense. So, you know, why aren't these people putting a percentage or a half a percentage of what they're making in profit into effective programs to assist people to get off the substances that are binding them? You know, they could make a huge impact in our country. You know, 78% of violent crime is fueled by drugs and alcohol.
Okay, but like, I've always been on the argument of just let's legalize a whole bunch of this stuff. Because then we take it out of the hands of the criminals and we can tax it. And you know what? The pharmacy can give you those things. Like they give you all these drugs that make people feel better. You know, whether it's antidepressants or things that just numb you to the world. There's no difference. If you can give someone euphoria rather than that, good. Let them have some. Let them go in there as responsible adults and apply for it and they can get it over the counter. They can pay for it.
You know,
legitimately, get the real stuff, not the stuff that's been cut with 100,000 other powders that's going to kill them slowly.
You know, that is another controversy within myself. Because intellectually, I agree with that. Spiritually, I can't agree with it because it goes against the principles of what I believe. But for me, if you could decriminalize it for people that use it, you are definitely walking in the right direction of ending this problem. Portugal has proven it. And you can't go against actual physical proof. So if legalizing it is going to encourage people, even though people are going to use whether it's legal or whether it's illegal. I mean, we really need to get to a place where we understand that, you know. If cocaine is legal, people will use it. If cocaine is illegal, people will use it. The war on drugs in America has cost them trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, and it has really just gone in reverse. It hasn't had any impact whatsoever. So we really do have to try a different approach. And like you say, you know, we talk about a responsible adult going, you know, the minute you're on drugs, you're not a responsible adult anymore. You know, you're a person that is addicted
What is the biblical position on substance abuse?
Okay, the biblical position is this.
Because they didn't have crystal meth back in the days when the guys were cobbling out the tablets of the Ten Commandments.
Hey, I don't know. If you look at what some of those guys did, you know, I have my doubts. But, you know, because some of those guys were maniacs.
One guy got eaten by a whale and spat out. And don't tell me he wasn't high.
Yeah, fortunately, though, you know, we need to read the story properly. It wasn't a whale. But the thing is that, the thing goes like this. In Revelation, the book of Revelation, and in one or two other places in the Bible, it talks about sorcery and witchcraft. Now, if you go and translate the original, you were speaking about the Greeks, it was written in Greek, the original Greek, the word that they used there was pharmakia for sorcery, which was a potion that was put together in order to make people get high so that they can get in touch with the spiritual realms, pretty much like peyote cactus that the Red Indians were using and that type of thing. And that is the spiritual background in terms of the use of drugs.
And God doesn't like that stuff?
Doesn't like that stuff because, you know, we're not designed to be in touch with that until it's time for us to be in touch with it.
Okay.
So, you know, the word is against that. Okay. So, but the thing is this, is that, you know, whether it's legal or whether it's illegal, you know, South Africa's sitting in the middle of a drug pandemic. We're not even in an epidemic anymore.
You think the numbers are so bad?
It's insane. I mean, I can show you stuff on my phone. We went into a place in Funabal the other day to do a small, initiative. You know, just hand out free food and to addicts, and they're sitting on the pavement shooting up. Man, the cops are driving past. It's no more. It's not even hidden anymore.
Do you think it's much harder to be a young person in South Africa now than it's ever been in terms of avoiding drugs?
Absolutely. You know, my generation of guys, we were the test pilots for these drugs to our discredit. You know, we're the guys that made them popular, and we're the guys that started pushing them, you know. When I started doing drugs, there were no such thing as Nigerian drug dealers. You know, we got our drugs from Mayfair and from Hillbrow, from South yeah. Africans. White, black, colored, pink, green, yellow South Africans, you know. So there was none of that. And then one of the hotels, you know, there were a couple of Nigerians that moved in there, two or three. And then the next minute, by 1993, 94, Hillbrow was pretty much taken over by these drug syndicates.
Yeah.
So, and that was our fault because we were paying for them to come out here and sell us the drugs. And so now it's got to the point where kids are selling drugs to kids at school. So it's much more difficult now to make correct choices, you know.
Listen, you're a very inspiring guy. You're an interesting dude to talk to. I reckon that we've only scratched the surface in terms of the stories you've got.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to hear about what happens in those bouncing syndicates. I would love to hear about what happened in the police station in Hillbrow.
Mm.
There's so much that we could still talk about, but I appreciate you coming to visit us this morning.
Thank you very much.
The good work. If people want to know where to get hold of you, because there are going to be a lot of people who are going to hear this now and go, oh, my God, my kid, you know, how can they find you?
They can get hold of us at www.nodrugs.co.za. We also have...
That's a good URL.
Yeah.
Nodrugs.co.za.
And we've also got an intervention team called Drug Squad, where we actually go into crack houses and nightclubs and these types of things to take people out where we're legally empowered to do so.
Does that mean a rifle? You take it...
If need be. I mean, I've gone in and dragged guys out at gunpoint.
Really?
Yeah. You know, I use those old...
You're not afraid, huh?
No, bud. It's about life.
Are you afraid
of
anything?
Yes, I am, eh? You know, fear, I'm not a Superman by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, I've got that intrinsic, I'm still a cop at heart, and, you know, I want to serve and I want to protect. And if that means, you know, going into a crack house to pull a young man or a young girl out of that place and risk my own life to do it, well, then so be it, eh? You know, somebody has to take a stand and we're willing to do it, eh?
All right. Yeah. Very well. Very good luck. And
Thank you.
I think that it's tremendous work. If you can rescue some people from themselves, if you can help them find some way out of the danger zone, then good for you. This is terrific. Thank you so much. All right.
Thanks, Gareth.
Pleasure to meet you, Dave. Dave Barber. Pastor Dave Barber. He's a pastor in Vereniging. He and his wife opened up a Christian-centered drug rehab center, and you can find out all about that. Plus, if you want to find out more, you can read his book, Cracked and Restored.
That's it.
It's still available?
From us, yeah.
There we go. So you have to go to nodrugs.co.za.
That's right.
To find out more. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pleasure to talk to you, man.
This is CliffCentral.com.